You're listening to the podcast of Studio 360 from Public Radio International and WNYC, where each week Kurt Anderson brings you great stories and conversation about creativity, pop culture, and the arts. We have a great website, too. Visit studio360.org to find out more.
It's like building a cathedral, but not in space, in time.
It's about what the body feels and what the body wants.
I must say, there's nothing quite like it.
This is Studio 360 from WNYC in New York and Public Radio International. I'm Kurt Anderson. On today's show, the orchestrators who create that big Broadway sound, even when there's not a lot to work with.
He doesn't read music, and he basically says, I want it to go like this.
And we look at the enduring power of the wah-wah pedal.
When it was invented, they likened it to the sound of a baby crying.
My guest today is the author and thinker, Lawrence Weschler. That's all ahead in Studio 360, where art and real life collide. Back in the 1970s, one of my favorite college teachers was Daniel Bell. Right around the time he taught me, he published an influential and controversial essay called The Cultural Contradictions of Capitalism. Professor Bell's idea, in a nutshell, was that our swinging modern culture promoted radical ideas and sensibilities, like rock and roll, for instance, that are antagonistic to the underlying conservative idea of Western society. That was a full decade before MTV, before the great wellspring of countercultural expression in this country was a multi-billion dollar enterprise owned by a giant media colossus, the Viacom Corporation. In other words, smart American capitalists are perfectly happy selling anti-capitalist, anti-establishment songs and videos as long as they've got a good beat and they're easy to dance to. The cultural contradictions have only gotten more extreme. And frankly, I revel in them. I wouldn't want to live in a society without some paradox and contradiction. I mean, if there were no contradictions, the media colossus owned by Rupert Murdoch would be consistently conservative.
Fox's Linda Vester now shows us how
Murdoch controls the conservative Fox News Network and the conservative Weekly Standard magazine and the conservative New York Post. But then there's Rupert Murdoch's Fox Entertainment Network. It is the most titillating TV network, the network that most shamelessly appeals to our base instincts. It's the one that put on Married with Children, which was the smuttiest sitcom of its era.
Love and marriage.
And game shows like Studs and Who Wants to Marry a Millionaire. Fox also happens to be the network that now airs the series Boston Public. Last season, Boston Public included stories about a high school girl who performs oral sex to win an election for class president, and another episode about a high school girl working as a stripper. The conservative culture warriors are no longer keeping quiet about Murdoch and Fox and this particular cultural contradiction. Earlier this month, a coalition of groups, including Morality in Media, the Christian Coalition, and the American Decency Association, sent an open letter to the chairman of the Federal Communications Commission. The letter demands that the FCC force Fox to get rid of Boston Public in prime time and to clean up its schedule. I don't usually think of myself as a defender of decency, but I'll admit I always enjoy it when the self-righteous and ideological of whatever stripe have their inconsistencies and hypocrisies exposed. By the way, when I went to the websites of Murdoch's Fox News and the Weekly Standard to see how they'd covered the FCC protest, an issue of great concern to their core audiences, I discovered absolutely nothing. Not a peep about the religious conservatives' angry letter. This is Kurt Anderson in Studio 360.
Oh.
On today's Design for the Real World, the writer Akiko Bush watches her kids' baggage mutate toward high style, along with the rest of their accessories.
Everything my kids are outfitted with, from their sneakers to their techno textile fleece sweaters to their baseball caps, has been designed to the hilt. Design for kids is no stranger to space age materials, witty graphics, and provocative logos. Kids love gear and baggage. A lot of kids were toted around in these packs, backpacks or front packs, as infants. And my theory is that there's some kind of lingering subliminal memory of that. Now they have their own packs, and they seem to know that this is where you put the good stuff, the important stuff, the stuff that really matters. And then it makes them, in turn, feel more important and responsible. Backpacks really embody this idea of legitimized secrecy. And, you know, now they have backpacks for all kinds of specific activities. My son has a special backpack for his skateboard. My other son has this little mini pack that goes on the back of his snowboard binding where he puts his chapstick, apparently. Every morning, my two sons go off, lightweight, 60, 70-pound kids toting 25-pound book bags, which makes for a real problem with balance. Kids tend to lean forward, and as you're growing up, the whole idea is that you're supposed to keep your spine straight. Also, slinging the thing over your shoulder is a real problem. That's really the worst thing, because that curves the spine to the side, and that can make your muscles develop unevenly. Also, if the straps are too thin, those cut in and cut off your circulation. So you have to wonder why the design of these packs is about styling and not about figuring out some way to re-engineer them so that fifth graders don't need to go see the chiropractor at the end of each semester. My own theory is that this has to do with books. Maybe it's part of the backlash against the digital age, but we seem to value the physicality of books. I mean, if we don't read them, at least we're carrying them around. And I think there's this idea that if we can't teach kids to read, then at least if we're causing their spines to curve carrying them around, that's a step in the right direction.
Akiko Bush is the editor of the book Design Is, an anthology of pieces from Metropolis Magazine. I'm Kurt Anderson in Studio 360, and it's time now for this week's cover story. There's a theater and opera director I know named Ted Altshuler. Ted teaches at Juilliard, and once he was having a terrible time coaching a particular tenor. The guy's voice was fine, but he just couldn't stir up any palpable passion for the opera's big love scene. He'd lean over, look in his partner's eyes, and completely lose it.
The soprano just made him a wreck. It was, made him a nervous wreck. He was married and very religious, and another woman made him nervous.
So Ted, being the resourceful director he is, told the tenor, forget the woman you're singing to. Forget people entirely. Think of something that you desire guiltlessly. Think of...
Pastrami.
Pastrami is a common...
I work with a tenor who could have a great love scene about a pastrami sandwich. I asked him to use his sense of taste and his sense of smell and touch, and to just indulge himself, since sex is about smell and about touch and about taste. It's not just about some rarefied vision of love. It's about what the body feels and what the body wants, and it's messy and touchy and tactile.
Ted Altshuler's food visualization stunt is not the kind of thing you'd expect to result in a magnificent aria. And that's why it's wonderful, because it's a trick and it gives the tenor exactly what he needs for a soulful performance. We're talking today about tricks of the artistic trade. These are the secret techniques and surprising tools that help artists do their work. My guest today is Lawrence Weschler, who was for 20 years one of the New Yorker's great writers and is now simply a magnificent author in his own right. His book on the artist Robert Irwin's garden at the Getty Center in Los Angeles will come out later this year. Wren Wechsler, welcome back to Studio 360.
Thank you. It's great to be here again.
Wren, we thought of you immediately for this show as we started putting it together about the secret techniques and methods of artists because of your involvement in the brouhaha sparked by the artist David Hockney. As you described in your New Yorker article, Hockney had a kind of blinding revelation a couple of years ago that artists, painters, after about 1420 or 1425, were using optical devices like lenses and before that mirrors to paint their old master paintings.
Well, actually, the way it began now about 2.5 years ago, he was at the Anger Show. Remember this great show, the Metropolitan? He saw it in London. And he was looking particularly at the drawings, a set of drawings that Anger did in the early 19th century of people who, in Rome, that Englishmen who were just going by, and people who he just had a few hours to draw. And they were stunning drawings. I think you have a tape of him talking about that.
Let's listen.
I blew some of them up on a Xerox machine just to look at them a bit better. And I started to notice that the lines reminded me of Andy Warhol. He would project a photograph and trace the line. The line has a traced look. And to my surprise, some of these had a line similar to that. So I thought, well, 1812, how could it be done? And on a hunch, I thought, I wonder if he used a camera lucida.
That was David Hockney from the BBC documentary about him and this debate. He refers to the camera lucida,
which camera lucida is basically a prism, a little tiny prism about the size of your eye, at the end of a rod. And the flat of the prism is parallel to the paper below, and then the triangles go below it. And if I have it, if I'm looking down at my paper below, it will reflect into my eyes your face, which you don't see on – it doesn't project it down onto the paper. It reflects into my eyes, and I can see both my hand and your face simultaneously. And the way it's useful is it allows you to very quickly mark where the pupils are, the contours of the nostrils, the lips, the ears, and so forth. And you can very quickly do stuff that takes hours and hours otherwise. Then it's the work of genius. And clearly some people do it better than others and so forth, and the ones who do it best are really geniuses. What was interesting was he became convinced almost immediately that earlier painters had been doing this as well, and he pushed it originally back as far as Caravaggio. Caravaggio, we know, is famous among his contemporaries, is criticized because he could never do an ideal human being. He always had to have the person standing in front of him, an actual person. This was very much looked down upon by his other artists. He could only do it in cellars, in bright, raking light in cellars. There are all kinds of things that convinced David that he would have been using a camera obscura. Now, a camera obscura consists of me putting a curtain between you and me, having a lens, and your face, if you're in bright light, goes through the lens onto a blackened canvas. Hockney, in the meantime, had started something very funny. He had put a photocopying machine, a color photocopying machine, in the middle of his studio. And he, in effect, he has a huge library of books, and he Xeroxed the entire history of art.
And in the same documentary, he talks about that very thing. Let's listen to David Hockney.
In my studio, we pinned up hundreds of color photocopies of paintings. Paintings which seemed to have an optical look and paintings that did not. Slowly, we got a kind of order. I put Northern Europe at the top and Southern Europe at the bottom. The wall was necessary because I could then sit back and scan centuries of Western painting. We worked back further and further, and finally we got to a date where beyond that, it is very different. And that date is approximately 1420.
This is what the wall looks like. It is the length of a tennis court. His studio is over a tennis court. It is 2 stories high. It is shingled like a photo collage of the entire history of Western art from 1350 to 1850. But anyway, this guy Falco came, a physicist, has a huge lab. at University of Arizona. And he said, I'm looking for a particular kind of picture with certain characteristics. He was kind of reviewing, like a general reviewing the troops they were looking at. And he eventually came upon one particular image by Lotto. And it was a useful image because it had a tabletop. It had a rug on the tabletop. And the rug had a regular repeating pattern. Whether it was centimeters or inches, it was a unit measure. And at the far end were the husband and wife looking. And what was weird is that the middle of the table was out of focus. At that point, Falco, the physicist, literally ripped out an envelope. And on the back of the envelope started doing things like, well, if you look at this and you look at this and you look at this cosine, sine, tangent, blah, 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 I can tell you, and he did various calculations, I can tell you the exact diameter of the lens that was used, I can tell you the thickness.
Although it proves only that
Lotto,
that one painting was done.
And at that point.
Isn't there something of the trying to prove that these great masters were not so great after all, trying to bring them down to your level?
Well, I mean, there is the old anxiety of influence issue here and so forth. Hockney, I think, feels very strongly and articulates this very strongly that he's not saying that at all. What he would say, one way of putting it is it doesn't matter what happens. The lines don't matter. It's what happens between the lines. He is in absolute awe of Van Eyck, of Velasquez, and so forth. And and Hulls, by the way, is somebody he talks about a lot. And their ability to paint, which is, you know, eyes make marks, optical instruments don't make marks. At the end of the day, parenthetically, he's not even that interested in this particular 400-year of history period from 1420 to 1820. What he's interested in, and the major thing that what he's devoted to talking about, is what happens when chemical photography is invented. Because at that point, artists fall away from what he calls the optical.
And it's beginning in the 1840s.
Invented, by the way, by people who were bad at using camera lucidas. That's literally how Talbot tries to use a camera lucida, says, God, it would be great if I could get some chemicals to do this, and finds one. You know, and it's called the pencil of nature, as it's called at that point. And what happens at that point is artists no longer try to make something optically exact, optically meaning, in effect, closing one eye, standing still, you know, and so forth. They instead start to make things more true to life, which is to say moving, impressionism, expressionism, cubism, multiple vanishing points, multiple vantages, and so forth. And for Hockney, it is the return of awkwardness after it's been away for 400 years that is the great moment for art.
That film photography released painters from this sort of slavish representation.
And it allowed for all kinds of exciting stuff. Now, one of the things he then further says is that we're at a very interesting point right now where chemical photography is over, what with Photoshop and everything. The hand is back in the camera, and you are now at a very exciting moment where the optical and the photographic and the painterly are all intertwining again. There's a whole kind of delta thing going on. And as he says, it's an extremely interesting time right now.
I'm Kurt Anderson, talking today with the writer Wren Wechsler. Coming up, we'll talk to orchestrators who turn pleasant melodies into big Broadway hits. Stay with us in Studio 360 from PRI, Public Radio International. This is Studio 360, and I'm Kurt Anderson. My guest today is the writer Wren Wechsler, and we're talking about various tricks of the trade, the little-known or even secret techniques behind painting, writing, and the music in Broadway shows. In musical theater, audiences are said to want melodies they can leave the theater humming. But lots of times, the sounds that people enjoy in a show are things they hardly realize they're hearing. The mood of the orchestra's arrangements, the way instruments play under and around and beyond the singer's lines. The people who handle all these elements are called orchestrators. And Sarah Fischko talked to two of them about how they do what they do.
Orchestration can be such a subtle thing, a matter of constantly adding and taking away. Look at the results Dvorak got just holding back the first violins in the Serenade for Strings. He starts off with the low strings. And then the whole color of the orchestra changes. Color is what orchestration is about.
You don't reveal everything you have because you give it away. There's nothing left. Save your big color for the moment when you need it.
Michael Starobin has learned a lot from his classical predecessors. He orchestrates Broadway musicals and some film scores. That means, for Broadway at least, that he's handed a simple, unadorned piano vocal score by the composer, and about 4 weeks later has to present a fully realized, orchestrated show to its cast and creators.
Almost never is there any indication of what instruments should play. Almost never is there an opinion about what should be in the band. That's really left to the orchestrator.
So he assesses what's needed and what's economically feasible, picks the band, and goes to work. As he did on Stephen Sondheim's Sunday in the Park with George, for example, a musical about an artist obsessed with painting flecks or dots which revealed images, as in the song Color and Light.
And George says, order.
An orchestrator has to know absolutely everything about a song, melody, structure, dramatic intent.
And it reflects both the painting and what his mind is thinking. And it builds and builds, and he gets more and more. Finally, he gets pretty ecstatic about what he's doing, and he says, more light. And the music explodes and shimmers.
More light. Color and light.
For me, the color that I really heard working on that was the harpsichord, as short and sharp as you could get. It was all about finding the staccato sounds, the different colors to match what was simply done on the piano. This was coloring in the lines, so to speak. And in that sense, this is orchestration at its simplest, which is, here's a drawing with no colors, fill in red, white, and blue where you see it.
There are only about 8 or 9 orchestrators doing all the shows on Broadway. Most of them learn their craft the hard way.
I had to write orchestrations in the same room as people rehearsing another song.
Jonathan Tunick, another major Sondheim collaborator, has since found a quieter place to orchestrate Follies, Company, Sweeney Todd, and others. He takes his cues from the composer.
A Little Night Music, for example. His remark about it was that it was romantic and mysterious, hint of perfume in the air. And I immediately thought of A Midsummer Night's Dream and the famous Scherzo by Mendelssohn from it. Of course, it called for a classical-type orchestra and a scherzo-like approach.
As the sweet imbecilities tumble so lavishly onto her lap.
Oh, Frederick, what a day it's been.
You need a sizable string section, light on the brass, you know, nice woodwind colors, and basically a late 19th century, perhaps a ballet orchestra.
With orchestration, of course, as with costume design and set decoration and every other detail of a show's creation, you can be on point in the 19th century 1 month, or swinging right up to the minute in the next.
We'll be so glad to see you.
As with Company.
We all wanted to be au courant at that time, in 1970, and the sound of Burt Bacharach was very much in our ears. We approached Company with a lot of that style.
Phone rings, door chimes, in comes Company.
When was it, 5 or 6 years ago when we revived it? With just some perfunctory editing, some changes in phrasing. Much of that 1970s sound just kind of disappeared. Some trumpet fills used to be phrased da 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 da. And if you just slur them over, da 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 dee da, they don't sound like the Tijuana Brass anymore.
And that's what it's all about, isn't it? That's what it's really about, really about.
Sondheim is known to both these orchestrators as a painstaking, thorough, and highly skilled writer of scores who spells out every note in his piano vocal scores, leaving nothing to chance. And then there is the other extreme, the hummer.
A hummer is a composer who is basically not an educated musician, so he doesn't read music. Sometimes he doesn't even play music, meaning play piano. And he basically says to an arranger, an orchestrator, I want it to go like this. And someone has to write it out, sometimes put chords to it.
But hummers can write hits too, and any input at all can be a comfort to the solitary orchestrator.
You have to sit alone in your room facing this blank paper. You're putting funny marks on paper and just taking it on faith that this is going to somehow turn into music. And you see that pile of paper with notes on it getting higher and higher, and you still have never heard any music except in your own brain. The big burst of energy, of course, comes at the orchestra rehearsal. Suddenly, all this energy that's been stored up on paper bursts forth into music. I must say, there's nothing quite like it.
So, if you get to a Broadway show, maybe you'll go out whistling the trumpet fill? For Studio 360, I'm Sarah Fischko.
I'm Kurt Anderson in Studio 360, talking today with the writer Wren Wechsler about various artistic tricks of the trade. I didn't know anything about orchestrators, Wren. That's how ignorant I am. And it's slightly disillusioning in the same way that David Hockney's idea about paintings are. But it also makes me think, hey, if I can just hum a tune, hire an orchestrator in an orchestra, I can write music.
There are millionaires who've tried that. It's ironic to me, actually, that it feels almost like the opposite of the Hockney problem. And in the terms that they were saying, Hockney says it doesn't matter where the lines go, it's what's in between the lines. And here you remember they said, you know, they give you the lines and we put what's in between the lines. And the claim in a Broadway show is that the lines matter, the structure matters, the tunes matter.
Well, I'm sure if you talk to Stephen Sondheim and other composers, they may say something different.
But it feels like the music, the soulfulness of the music is what's between the lines. And it is funny. By the way, there's a great story I'm reminded of. Los Angeles in the 40s when Schoenberg was at somebody's house at a cocktail party and one of the studio heads was there. And he dragged Schoenberg over to the piano and says, come on, Arnie, play us a tune. And that's what a composer was thought to do in Hollywood, was you came up with tunes. I mean, Schoenberg, for example, would probably, you can assume, have done his own orchestration. That's what we think Schoenberg is. It is the case that in the American song tradition, it's often right away thought of as collaborative because it's both the lyric and the music. One of the things that's so funny is the way in which we have that songs always die at least two or three times in the obituary columns. For some reason, all these people live to be 90.
Rodgers and Hammerstein.
Sammy Cohen, all these people. And you find out that the person who did this song has just died. And then 3 years later, the person who did the same song has just died. It turns out it was one of them did the song, the music, one of the things. And now it turns out you're going to find out as time goes by that the orchestrators of all these things have also. So that's a whole other bag. I know that, for example, Mel Brooks is a hummer.
All the music and the producers began as just
And he's a very good hummer.
Yeah.
And by the way, I think that using Mel Brooks as an example, and I'm sure Stephen Sondheim is a more elaborate example, yes, the orchestrator goes and does it. If he comes back to Sondheim and says, no, that's not what was in my head, Sondheim wins that discussion.
Now, your grandfather was a composer.
Right.
Did he wrote all the parts? He didn't hire an orchestrator to just, here's the song, you go figure it out?
No. He was a composer in the Weimar era, Germany. He was contemporary of Hindemith, a little bit younger than Schoenberg. Eventually came to Hollywood. One of his great complaints, as a matter of fact, in Hollywood, Oscar Levant tells a story about how the way they would save money on my grandfather's scores in his Hollywood productions is they would just knock out the upper staves. And, you know, it used to drive him crazy. So there just weren't any cello parts. You know, and as far as he was concerned, he'd had this whole orchestra going. But my impression is that generally what we think of as classical composers do all the orchestration themselves. But I'm not even sure that's the case. And I'm prepared to be as shocked and frankly chagrined as you are.
Well, and if one could argue that there's perhaps a certain sameness among Broadway music. And indeed, if there are only eight or nine guys doing all of it, it begins to explain perhaps some similarity going on there. My guest today in Studio 360 is the writer Ren Weschler, and we're talking about tricks of the artistic trade. And one of the trades in which Ren and I know there are tricks is writing. We asked the great comedy writer Jack Handy to demonstrate a reliable trick from his and our professions. You may remember some of Jack's deep thoughts on Saturday Night Live. And without revealing what the trick is too soon, here's Jack Handy and his essay, The Power of Nature.
The Power of Nature by Jack Handy. People tend to think that an atom bomb is one of the most powerful things there is, and who could disagree? But the energy of a nuclear explosion is actually inconsequential compared to some of the forces nature can deliver. For instance, the eruption of Mount St. Helens, which flattened trees like so many toothpicks, was more than equal to the power released in several atomic blasts. And yet, Mount St. Helens was far from colossal in terms of natural history. The volcanic obliteration of the island of Krakatoa in 1883, an event which saw huge boulders tossed into the air like so many toothpicks, is perhaps a better example. So much debris was thrown into the atmosphere that for months afterward, sunsets around the world appeared unusually red, as if looking through a screen of red-painted toothpicks. But it isn't just volcanoes that can dispense such massive bursts of annihilation. Scientists now believe it was an exploding comet which caused a 20-mile-wide zone of devastation in Siberia in 1908, flattening trees like so many matchsticks, the kind that are pointed on both ends. As frightening as it may seem, the Earth has been struck thousands of times by such gigantic celestial missiles. It's true that many of these collisions occurred long before man appeared on the scene with his small, sharpened sticks, but many have happened since, and more are yet to come. But the immense natural power of the heavens can be benevolent as well. How many times have we gone outside after a good meal, picking our teeth with a household twig of some sort, and looked up at the sun, failing to appreciate the stupendous energy it represents, energy which makes life possible, providing warmth and growing the trees which we use for so many products. Ironically, the sun, like an atomic warhead, is nuclear-powered, but the scale is vastly different. Comparing the sun to a nuclear bomb is like comparing a telephone pole to a much smaller dental telephone pole. And yet the sun itself is far from being the most powerful phenomenon in the universe. A black hole, for instance, is a star crushed by enormous forces until it is no bigger than a hamster rolling pin. Its gravity is so strong that nothing can escape it, not even little wooden rockets. Certainly the greatest explosion that ever was not man-made, the Big Bang. It was so huge that if you witnessed it, it would make you suddenly spit out whatever might be sticking out of your mouth, even if it was cinnamon-flavored. But we need not look to outer space. Here on Earth, consider the tornado, with winds capable of uprooting trees as large as gigantic toothpicks, or the avalanche, sweeping everything before it without regard to where it came from or whether it could be used to pry out food. And what about the tides, on whose broad expanse our nuclear submarines are like so many ant totem poles? All these are capable of energies exceeding the typical atomic charge. But man, with his H-bombs and missiles, likes to think of himself as a powerful demigod, when he is really just a fragile stick figure. Perhaps if he can shed his arrogance, then one day nature will smile on him, and the smile will be completely free of spinach.
That was Jack Handy. I'm Kurt Anderson in Studio 360 talking today with the writer Ren Weschler, and we're talking about tricks of the trade. One of the principles of humor and of comedy, I guess, if there were such a thing, is repetition and the confounding repetition in that extreme and infuriating and wonderful case.
Well, I mean, in that case, it's a rhythm section. He's a drummer. And he's got, and he keeps hitting the drum. You know, he keeps hitting the toothpick drum, and so it's a whole riff. And the structure actually of music, I think, is much, when you're thinking about writing is much more like music than it's like painting, which is to say that they are both instances of architectonic, as my grandfather used to say, which is structure across time. It's form across time. That doesn't happen in a painting. It's like building a cathedral, but not in space, in time. And it has constriction. It has expansion. And in the cases we were just talking about, it has a rhythm.
It has literal rhythm.
Yeah, yeah. It has rhythm.
And in your case, speaking of your grandfather again, you discovered after the fact that some of your writing actually essentially are words to his music.
Well, it's very strange. My grandfather, Ernst Toch, was a composer who had no musical forebears, which is very unusual. He was without absolutely any musical talent in the family before or after. I am completely useless musically. As a child, he composed work for me to play on the piano after I'd been playing piano for 5 years, and I came to perform it for him, and he turned to my grandmother and said, just completely hopeless, you know, just give it up. And suddenly I didn't have to take piano lessons.
What a nice grandfatherly
Well,
image,
he didn't say
right.
to me, but I didn't have to take piano lessons anymore. However, I am very aware that as a writer, I think about music. All the metaphors I use are when I'm writing, when I'm composing, when I'm making things up, when I'm, you know, compounding things, are musical. Or when I edit, you know, when I'm editing somebody else, I say, you know, the syncopation is wrong here. I think you should change key. All those kinds of metaphors. I don't even know what they mean, but I know exactly what they mean in terms of – by the way, he has a book called The Shaping Forces in Music, which has 500 musical examples. I can't understand a single note of the examples, and yet he is exactly talking about what it is to be a writer of narrative, in this case of musical narrative. Now, what's weird for me is that when I am writing, I often go through periods of blockage, and then I begin to warm up and get going, and then I start writing. And I often, when it starts going well, I will hear music going in my head. And often the rhythms of the music and so forth will translate directly into the writing. And afterwards, would I stop and think, God, what was that? It turns out almost invariably to be one of my grandfather's pieces. It's incredibly weird for me.
Do you have other deliberate tricks as a writer that we can now reveal to the audience for the first time?
Well, not a question so much as tricks, but it is all about form and structure. And when I am blocked, my wife and daughter will go off to work and they'll come back and I am playing with blocks. I literally am playing with wood blocks. And I will have huge cathedrals that I will have built out of these blocks on the kitchen table. And my daughter, who at one point was 4 and 5 years old, was told not to play with daddy's blocks. And in fact, I'm not thinking at all about the problems of the topic that I'm dealing with, but I'm clearly in some way thinking about structure, because eventually I begin to think about structural issues and that becomes interesting to me and then I'm able to start working on things again.
Have you ever used any of the software that's available to write fiction and prose nonfiction, as and certainly a screenwriting software, yeah, of which there are many varieties.
I write longhand. eventually I'll put it on the computer. But
you claim you write longhand. I think you're like one of those painters who claims you didn't use an optical device, and you really
well. I print very carefully. No, eventually I'll put it on the computer and so forth. But actually, I find, I mean, this is something I don't recommend, but I find the panic of the blockage, the intense self doubt. Is part of the process, and part of the process is forgetting how to do it. And part of the vividness and the vivacity of the writing is the vividness of being there as you remember how to do it. And writing that's very much alive is, oddly enough, not formulaic, except in the formula of constantly having to rediscover itself that way.
So terror and rescue from the terror, I guess, is the trick of the writer's trade. How comforting.
There you go. I mean, it's not a lifestyle I would recommend to anyone.
I'm Kurt Anderson, talking today with the writer Ren Wechsler. Coming up, we'll look at the little box behind many of your favorite rock songs. The wah-wah pedal. Stay with us in Studio 360 from PRI, Public Radio International. I'm Kurt Anderson in Studio 360, and my guest today is the writer Wren Wechsler. We're talking about tricks of the trade. Musicians love their tools. That's why there's a cult around Steinway grands. It's why B.B. King calls his guitar Lucille. And it's why, for years, no rock musician would ever be far from a wah-wah pedal. The wah, as it's called, is a little smaller than your foot, and it does one simple thing very well. Dominic Alley tells us how the tiny wah changed popular music.
You're listening to me play my electric guitar through a wah-wah pedal. I love this sound, not just for its funkiness, but for its history. The wah-wah did a tour of duty in Vietnam, dropped LSD at Woodstock, and hung out with Jimi Hendrix. It made John Travolta a star. You may have even lost your virginity to the sound of the wah. So what is this miraculous invention, and where does it come from? I asked Art Thompson. He wrote the book Stompbox, a history of guitar fuzzes, flangers, phasers, echoes, and wahs.
In the mid-60s, there was a guy named Brad Plunkett who had been signed a task at the Thomas Organ Company, which had taken over the design and manufacture of Vox amplifiers. And in doing so, he came up with this circuit that produced this effect. It's what became the wah-wah.
Vox's fabulous new wah-wah pedal opens the door to a variety of great new sounds. Here's how it operates. The guitar plugs into the wah-wah pedal with a standard chord. Then the pedal plugs into the amp with another chord. The entire foot goes on the pedal. When the foot is rocked forward, the guitar sound becomes sharp. As the foot is rocked back, the sound becomes mellow. By rocking the foot back and forth, we get the wah-wah effect.
Like hairstyles and clothes, different musical effects come and go out of fashion. An effect that defines pop music in one era sounds totally cheesy a few years later. But the wah-wah pedal remains a timeless classic. For musicians, it's the equivalent of the little black dress. The pedal's popularity is no surprise. We've always loved the sound. British trumpeter Clyde McCoy used a mute to create this sound back in 1931. The earliest wah-wah pedals even featured his picture. For wah connoisseurs, these Clyde McCoy pedals are like Fabergé eggs. Jimmy Page, Jeff Beck, and Eric Clapton plugged into the pedal early on, but it was Jimi Hendrix who immortalized the wah. The wah-wah is a musical chameleon. It's appeared in tie-dye at Woodstock and sported a leather jacket in Harlem. It's the sound of blaxploitation movies like Shaft and Superfly. In the 1970s, there was no stopping the wah-wah. It was behind everything. TV themes, movie soundtracks, even commercials. You couldn't play a rock gig without it. It had a magical power over its listeners. Randy Bachman of the Guess Who found out the hard way in front of 30,000 people.
And a guy comes to the front of the stage, unplugs both cords, puts it under his jacket, walks out of the room. I am dead silent. There's no way you can put a guitar chord into a guitar chord. And I'm motioning to my roadie, like, get over here. And he's saying, what's wrong? What's wrong? He looks down, and there's no way he could put the two male jacks together.
Back then, a musician would stand by his wah, even if it meant physical danger.
The whole spotlight is on me because I'm playing all these riffs alone. I'm using a wah-wah. I'm wearing white pants. And flying out of the audience comes a full-sized drink carton full of mustard, and it hits me right above the knee. It looks like stuff from a baby's diaper. It's from the hot dog stand, right? And it runs down my leg. So I'm going to be cool and not run off stage. I'm going to sit there and finish my solo. And I'm wearing leather shoes, which have nails in them, in the soles. And as the mustard gets down into my shoes, I start getting shocks because the mustard is wet through the wah-wah pedal, right?
While Bianca, Andy, and Halston danced under the mirror ball at Studio 54, the wah-wah worked overtime. Tragically, it was not to last. The 80s will forever be known as the decade without wah. Electronic drums, synthesizers, and sophisticated guitar effects had taken over. The wah-wah was about as cool as polyester bell-bottoms at a Devo concert. The once mighty pedal was now relegated to pawn shops and flea markets. Some manufacturers stopped making them, while others went out of business altogether. It looked as if the wah was headed for the big Radio Shack in the sky. During its retirement, the wah was used from time to time, mostly by nostalgic headbangers. But this little lost tool had an unlikely savior, the hip-hop DJ. Can I get a witness? Yo, Griff, move past one's dad on the judge and the jury. Hold him hostage. Time for Terminator X to step in and show him that he's in effect, boy. Yeah. By sampling old funk, pioneering hip-hoppers put the wah back in the spotlight. Innovative musicians are still using the wah as part of their audio collages. Roger Salveson is a pop music producer in Vancouver, Canada.
Yeah, lots of DJs hooking up their turntables to the wah-wah and actually scratching and getting really cool effects by listening to that through the wah-wah. It sounds good. Yeah, most modern synthesizers will imitate a wah-wah sound. In fact, you know, most new synthesizers you can buy today, you know, have a built-in effect called wah-wah.
This all brings us to the 21st century. Is there room for the humble wah-wah in a postmodern pop music landscape? Art Thompson, senior editor of Guitar Player magazine.
There's something so inherently humanistic about it that I think people will always like it. There's something just very kind of pleasing and physical about it. It's something that you work rhythmically with your body while you're playing, and those effects seem to have great staying power, and I don't see those ever going away. They're just part of the guitar player's bag of tricks.
Do you think the wah-wah says anything about sort of the human condition?
When it was invented, they likened it to the sound of a baby crying, and maybe there's something, you know, sort of etched in our DNA code about that.
For Studio 360, I'm Dominic Alley in Vancouver, Canada.
I'm Kurt Anderson in Studio 360 with the author Ren Weschler, and we're talking about artists' tools and tricks. Ren, one of the great virtues of the wah-wah pedal is the fact that it is onomatopoeically named. Wah-wah.
It's also, does it bother you that they're using a wah-wah pedal? Are you bothered that they're using a pedal instead of doing that thing with their hand?
Yes, frankly. What, instead of having a mute that you put on the...
That's an example. I mean, I think the people who invented the wah-wah pedal did something cool.
Yeah.
And they were musicians, and they were tinkerers as well, and there wasn't a distinction between it. That was all one continuous thing. I know in the case, by the way, my own grandfather, not to always bring him up, but he died...
He used a wah-wah pedal when he was jamming.
Well,
he
would have liked to be able to. He died in 64, and the last 15 years of his life, he was endlessly searching for new sounds. And he heard the sounds in his head, and electronics labs had not yet gotten to the point where they could make those sounds. He came to Columbia, which at that point Otto Luening and some other people were trying to get electronic music started. And he came and he stayed there for months trying to get these sounds that he heard, and he couldn't quite get them. But I'm sure were he alive 10 years longer, he would have been using all kinds of things. I don't know, a wah-wah pedal. But he, in fact, did use a hisser in his Third Symphony, which was a compressed air with a nozzle that makes an incredibly weird sound.
You also, I think, bring up a good point about the fact that this is a device, a tool, a machine that we don't begrudge anyone using. And it makes me think that in this day and age where everything is possible digitally, where any kid or any person can have synthesizers and painting programs, does that mean that we're at the end of an era of artists' tricks?
I don't know. I mean, it seems to me at the end of the day, the art is soulfulness. And it's not clear to me that that is something that's digitally available. Apparently, the Holy Grail, the last thing that computer animators are trying to do, and they just can't do it, they can't figure out why they can't get faces right. It's obvious. The face is the seat of the soul. And soul is not something that exists digitally.
Wren Wechsler, thank you for joining me again in Studio 360.
Thank you.
Wren Wechsler is a writer and journalist. He has a book coming out later this year on the garden at the Getty Center in Los Angeles, created by the artist Robert Irwin. You can find out more about Wren and his work and see a slideshow of images from today's program on our website, studio360.org. They give out the Grammys next week, awards for Best New Artist, Best Liner Notes, Best Polka Album. One of the contenders for Best Classical Crossover Album has a fascinating backstory. The album is called Celluloid Copeland by the EOS Orchestra, and it consists entirely of obscure Aaron Copland film scores that were resurrected from the bowels of the Library of Congress. Some of the music is a lot more modernist than Aaron Copland's best-known works like Fanfare for the Common Man and Appalachian Spring. To close our show today, I asked the EOS Orchestra conductor, Jonathan Sheffer, to take us through one piece on the disc. It's called The City. It's a soundtrack that Copland was hired to write for a film shown at the 1939 New York World's Fair.
I remember seeing it when I was growing up. It was one of those, you know, seventh grade social studies things. It was a documentary by a very well-known group of leftist producers and writers. Lewis Mumford wrote this text, and it was a very interesting film about the possibility of a green city of the future, which really looks to us in this film like a very, you know, upscale suburb, a very planned suburb. What happens very often is with so-called geniuses is that their few works become sort of amberized and the rest of it is just sort of drops away. It's true of almost all of the composers of the 20th century. The romantic composers, you know, we generally play a large amount of the repertoire. Brahms, Beethoven, it's played. You don't just play three of the symphonies. What happens in the 20th century is we take three or four works, that's Stravinsky, I'm happy, don't tell me about the rest. And it's really an effort for people to listen anew. And one thing that happened when we did this record, and also we had a PBS show about Copland, people who are very savvy about music said to me, I thought I knew all of Aaron Copland's music, and this is music I've never heard. That, to me, is interesting. Well, movie music, of course, imitated him and everyone that came after him. I mean, you can imagine him going out to Hollywood, as he did. He knocked on doors in the mid-30s and nobody was really interested. And it was a time very dominated by the Europeans, by Korngold and Rocha and Steiner. And this was a lush Straussian music. And here he came with his acerbic and, you know, empty harmonies. And he managed to find directors and films that were sympathetic to that. And after that, everybody just did what he was doing. So The City forms, I think, the bridge from Copland to Hollywood. Mm-hmm. Copland began as a modernist, pure and simple. And then he said, well, I'm going to either continue as a modernist or I'm going to really try to thread this American thing into it. And of course, what he ended up doing was writing things that sounded like folk songs. After this period, after World War II, the 50s and 60s, the last part of his career, life became very confusing. And the atonality of music swept the world. Copland, trying to respond to it, became very urban again, you might say. So he had this kind of middle period, which we now look back on with a certain sentimentality, I think. I happen to think The City, for me, is the core of this record. This is the thing that set Copland off in this American direction. This is all the time of Billy the Kid. It's just, he's just coming to terms with that. How do I find something American and World War II looming? And I think it was a very, very seminal work in his career, and I'm very much in favor of people getting to know this music.
Jonathan Scheffer, conductor of the EOS Orchestra. Celluloid Copland is nominated for Best Classical Crossover Album at next Wednesday's Grammy Awards. Studio 360 is produced by WNYC along with PRI, Public Radio International. The production team includes
Julie Burstein,
Carrie Hillman,
Peter Clowney,
Jocelyn Gonzalez,
Steve Nelson,
Michelle Siegel,
Lital Molad,
Andy Lancet,
Elaine Heinzman,
Amy Jeffries,
Lou Olkowski.
And special thanks this week to Judith Kampfner. The music is by David Van Tegum. I'm Kurt Anderson, and I do hope you'll join us next week here in Studio 360.
Studio 360 is co-produced by WNYC Radio and Public Radio International and is funded in part by the National Endowment for the Arts, the Horace W. Goldsmith Foundation, the David B. Gold Foundation, and the Wallace Reader's Digest Funds, supporting education, the arts, and culture to enrich community life. Additional funding comes from this and other PRI stations nationwide.
PRI, Public Radio International.
Next time in Studio 360...
When I was growing up, we called it sarcasm.
I talk with Dave Eggers about the earnest and the ironic.
You cannot separate sarcasm or a certain amount of knowingness from humor in the 20th century. I don't know how far you'd have to go back to find humor that wasn't knowing.
Dave Eggers, next time in Studio 360 from PRI.
You've been listening to Studio 360 with Kurt Anderson from Public Radio International and WNYC. You can find out more about this episode, access our entire program archive, and leave us a comment at studio360.org.